cruel intentions and new dimensions. When I was in second grade, I did a somewhat bad thing. That morning started off well. I brought in $2 to buy some pops, frozen pops that were being sold by the fifth graders to raise money to go to Washington, D.C. or some such place for a trip. And I accidentally ripped one of the dollar bills. And so I went up to the lunch lady, because for breakfast time, that cafeteria area is open. And so she taped up that dollar for me. And this was my tooth fairy money. And I've been trying to think, like, wow, my teeth came out late for being second grade. But anyway, it was my tooth fairy money, and I was very excited, because it's difficult to get your hands on cash when you were, what, 7, 8 years old. Who's had that same problem, right? And it actually still is difficult. It doesn't seem to become a problem as you get older, and as my academic status informs that. So I went into class, and I put my $2 in my backpack, and, you know, just had class as usual. Now, some of you may have had one of these in grade school. I definitely had probably too many, but I had an enemy. And this enemy was Claudia. And I don't know why Claudia didn't like me, but I knew she did not like me. And I did not like her. And it was mutual. I don't know where it started, where it goes back to. I have no idea. I do remember envying her very, very long hair, because my mom like hacked mine off when I was like 6 years old. So I think that may have been the beginning of the feud. And so I went back at lunchtime to look for my $2, and it was gone. It was not in my backpack. And I was like, she took it. I knew it with like this deep, deep knowledge. Now, I'm going to tell you, I have not told anyone this story. This is something that I have kept buried very deep, what I did. It was bad. So I was like, I know Claudia did it. And I didn't know how to like bring charges against her in a way and like prove that I was in the right and that she stole my tooth fairy money. And so I decided to conduct a search. And so I did a search of all the backpacks. So our classroom was here, but you like went in the back, and there was this like long hallway in the back room where everybody's backpack was. And so while everybody was gone, like at lunch, I proceeded to go through everybody's backpack. And wouldn't you know it, my $2 was in Claudia's backpack. And you know how I knew it was my $2? Because it was taped up, right, from that morning. Yes. This is how I was as a second grader. And so I went up to my teacher and I was like, I lost my $2 and I'm pretty sure Claudia took it. And my teacher's like, how on earth would you know that? There is no way. I was like, no, 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 I saw her rummaging around back there and she saw me that morning. Lie, lie. And I was like, I know she has it. She was like, well, calm down, you know, that's a pretty big accusation. I was like, no, I want my $2. So that was enough to buy you 4 lollipops. And are those like frozen pops. So anyway, it turned into a pretty big deal. We like went into the back with Claudia, the teacher got out her backpack, and lo and behold, there were the $2, one of them taped up. And her parents had to come into school, my parents had to come into school, because she was claiming it was her $2. And I was like, you didn't lose any teeth? That is my tooth fairy money. I was very like intense about it being the tooth fairy money, you know, like it had been gifted to me from the gods or something. I think I was a pagan as a second grader. And so I set her up. I know I did. I mean, and then my coup de grace was bringing in the lunch lady to say, no, I taped up that dollar. Sadly, the repercussions were actually quite severe. Our entire class was banned from buying any frozen pops from the fifth graders. Yeah, that was intense. My teacher was intense. She was not playing around. And maybe this is because of the kind of school I was in, military schools. They do not joke around with breaking the law. And so when I think about that day, like as it goes back, I'm like, I know she did me wrong. Right? Like, I found the $2. I know I was right. You know, I was like, had some right intuition there. But is what I did any better in response to it?
is, did how I treat her really, did any of us like make out after the end of that entire ordeal? Our class, it actually kind of hurt the feeling of the class because suddenly we couldn't participate in something everybody in the school was doing, which was buying these frozen pops. And it kind of tainted future interactions between me and Claudia, as you can guess. It was not good. And like parents got brought in. I mean, it was a serious situation. I wish I could find Claudia to this day and apologize to her. There's no way. I mean, God, if you're working that way. Facebook, it's true. Try and find her. And I think for me, when I came to the passage in John 8 of the woman who was brought up with charges in front of Jesus, in front of everybody, I can't help but think of my time with Claudia and the trickiness and the strangeness of what do we do as a community, that what do we do with brokenness and sin and everybody acting a little bit shady? How do you walk out of that feeling a sense of justice has been done, God has worked here? What could I have done with Claudia? And what do we do here as we sit and want to partner together with each other in order to deal with the fact that there are cruel intentions in our midst, not merely in how we interact personally, but in systems of oppression, systems of injustice, things that are out of our control and things that are in our control? So I want to talk about that today. I want to talk about cruel intentions and what I think Jesus might be trying to do in this passage to help us conceive of new dimensions of interaction and being as a community that can kind of deal with a little bit of our shadiness. Then each of them went home. While Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, early in the morning he came again to the temple. All the people came to him and he sat down and began to teach them. Ooh, that should say John 7:53, not 7:1. So before I go too further into the passage, I don't know how many of you are hardcore biblical scholars, but if you read any current commentaries, you will find that this particular passage, this pericope of scripture, a lot of folks don't think it goes in John. And some people will put it in Luke. And if you look in the RSV Bibles right now in front of your pew, you're going to see some little quotation marks. And yeah, we're not really sure if it goes in this manuscript. But what I do want to share from my research, and one of the reasons that it is in all of our texts and in all of our Bibles, is because most scholars think that it's a very ancient tradition. And that's something that really is very possible that happened with Jesus and an interaction that they definitely think happened. It's in about half of the manuscripts that we know of, but what makes it more powerful and what folks think are the reason that we should really pay attention to it is because it gets at some really key things about what it means to be in community and what sin is and judgment and all that jazz. So a lot of scholars, even though they wouldn't necessarily place it here, still think that it's really important. And I think as we look over it and read it, and a lot of you probably know it kind of in the back of your heads, there's something really powerful here. And so that's my little biblical scholar caveat. Now we can move on. So Jesus is chilling and teaching people. And he's got a whole bunch of folks sitting down in front of him, and he is teaching them. Uh-oh. The scribes and Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and making her stand before all of them, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" Well, this is a setup. Oh, no, it's a trap. Yeah, it's a trap. It's a trap, folks. It's what I did to Claudia. What do we do? What do we do in this situation? Let's look a little bit more at the text. So it says the scribes and Pharisees brought a woman who'd been caught in adultery. Now, how do you catch someone in adultery unless you're just sitting at their house, just binoculars, waiting for something to happen? They clearly set her up. This is a total trap. She was somebody who was probably, they probably knew maybe she would be caught in adultery. Maybe they knew the guy that she would be sleeping with. But one of the important things, background to know about this, is back in those days, folks were not stoning people all the time for committing adultery. That was not the case. This is so incredibly extreme, what they're bringing before Jesus. Most of the time, if adultery was happening at that time period, folks were, they would just get a divorce. And Jewish texts confirm this, and a lot of the laws and things like that. The stoning thing is really over the top, first of all. And second of all, if you were going to stone somebody, you had to have a lot of evidence, a lot of witnesses who were all telling the same story. And so in order for that to be the case, it kind of points to it being a trap. Like, they had to have known that this was going to happen and kind of were setting this woman up. And in the same way, also setting up Jesus for this particular problem. What's also interesting and kind of makes it even more shady is that they bring her in front of Jesus publicly. At that point, if you were going to have a trial and bring charges against somebody, you didn't have to bring the person up in front of everybody and have a big show of it and kind of, it's an extra effort of humiliation for the woman to go this far in terms of trying her and with these charges. So that also, I mean, in the back of my head, I'm just thinking, wow, these scribes and Pharisees are really intent upon doing some wrong. And maybe they don't see it as doing some wrong, but they've set her up to be caught. And they're also further humiliating her by having this happen in such a public format. Oh, but then they go even further. Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say? Well, that's not what the law says. And they probably know that's not what the law says. The law is in Leviticus, and the law says, and it's also found in Deuteronomy, it says that your stoning should happen to the man and the woman. Not just the woman, it's both of them. And that word, and I'm sorry, I'm getting so like exegetical here, but it's so fun for this passage to know all this background. They say to stone such women, and they intentionally use the feminine noun there, when that's not the case that it was used at all. So not only are they further humiliating this woman, they've like caught her in this trap, they're now twisting the law to make it be okay to really particularly get at this. I mean, do you have to wonder what this woman did to them to deserve all of this? This is going really, really, really far. And it's all kind of to this effort of setting up Jesus. And that's why I think it's a trap, of course. So they said this to test him, so that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus then bent down and wrote with his finger on the ground. So now we get a sense that this isn't just for Jesus to be interpreting the law. They're not, you know, oh, teacher, will you tell us what to do in this situation? We don't know. Oh, they know what they're doing. They're very aware. They bring all this mess before Jesus, and they are going to all this trouble to put Jesus in a situation where he would be in trouble. So there are two ways to think of how Jesus is kind of set up in this situation. There we go. First is by popularity. Now, if Jesus says, stoner, go right ahead, then he's going to lose a lot of favor with folks that are really lenient when it comes to the law. He's been saying for a long time, like, I mean, up until this point, Welcome the sinners. Welcome all those who would be initially kind of cast out. I'm going to take the prostitutes, the tax collectors. They're welcome to the table. Let's all sit. I've come to heal the sick. I've come for the sinner. So for him to say stone her would probably, his character would be shot at that point, because it's not working with everything he's been saying up until that point. But if he says don't stone her, then he's going to lose a lot of popularity with those who are adherent to the law and have a lot of respect for the law and for what was said in Deuteronomy and Leviticus, even though they did kind of mess it up intentionally. So it could be that. It could be about Jesus's popularity and trying to mess with those who are following Jesus. But I think that would be, it doesn't make a lot of sense to go that far just to mess with somebody's popularity. There's got to be a bit more investment. And I think that there's more investment because of the word to test him. It seems like they would probably maybe also want Jesus to get in trouble. Not trouble just with those who follow, but maybe trouble with those in power. So there are two groups that are in power around Jesus' time that he's constantly going to, or he's going to be interacting with. There's the Roman law, Roman officials like Pilate, and then there are the Pharisees, or actually the Sadducees, who are the religious leaders at that time. So those are two people in power, those who are kind of in power over the Jewish community and kind of the authority, and then the Roman officials who are overseeing all of that as well. Now, if Jesus says to stone her, then he could get in trouble with the Roman authority, where you can't just act out on the death penalty. There's no death penalty for adultery in Roman law, so he could get in trouble for that. But if he says not to stone her, well, now they've got reason to say, oh, he's disagreeing with our religious law and the law that we have control over in this community. And I think it's more about testing him in that regard, of getting him in trouble with powers that be, so that they can then come up with some really legitimate reasons to bring accusations against him and be able to basically get to the point that we do eventually in the narrative at the cross. But at this point, the setup is trying to move us closer and closer to that point. I think that's more what it's about than about Jesus's popularity. So that's pretty messy. No matter what, I feel like at this point of the story, who on earth is going to get out of this situation with their hearts and with their souls intact? So you have the Pharisees and the scribes who have really done a lot of shady things in order to bring this woman to Jesus and present this particular kind of controversy, this particular kind of test for him. They are in trouble themselves. Because if we think about it, if Jesus does say, stone her, and then they are like, oh, wait, that means that we have to stone her, they could also get in trouble with the Roman officials. So I don't think they were really thinking that far ahead, sadly. And it would be on them. They would get in trouble as the elders because they would take most of the responsibility for the stoning. The woman is also in deep trouble. She was probably caught that morning at dawn. And so this whole time, she's been thinking and wondering, her life is at stake here. And she's dealing with a group of people who obviously have an agenda that has included her and is against her in really particular ways. And I can't imagine how she's going to survive in this community, and in this space and in this interaction, to be so publicly humiliated and brought out like that. So her heart and her soul are at stake in this interaction. And then there's Jesus. What is he supposed to do? How is he supposed to care for the woman who's there? But we also know she was committing adultery. There's no way that I'm going to say, oh, that's great, commit adultery. You know, Jesus don't care about that. No. That's wrong too. That's a matter of faithfulness and a matter of a commitment and a bond that's been broken. So I don't think Jesus is going to get on top of saying that everything she did was fine, right? So he has to respond to that in some way. But he has to respond to the scribes and the Pharisees. I mean, if we know the character of Jesus, we know he's not a big fan of being tested like this. And he knows that these sorts of things, I mean, they keep happening to him. How is he going to respond in a way that has compassion for all of those involved, that's going to take into account the hearts and souls of these people that have now been kind of just put out there right in the open? I can't help but think that this is just the classic scenario of a rock and a hard place. That there in the midst of cruel intentions, when we do something wrong and then that kind of starts, you know, snowballing and gaining and gaining and gaining, it gets out of our control and suddenly we're faced with consequences we never signed up for. We never knew this would be possible. When I think about what I did to Claudia, I'm like, I had no idea what it would become. And I didn't realize that my responding with more wrong to the situation and my kind of really shady ethical principles would end up hurting her even more in a pretty public, humiliating kind of way as well. And I didn't realize the cost that that would have on my own heart and my own soul as I really struggled with, what kind of person am I at the end of the day? Like, what does this mean about me? And it's something that always kept coming up for me. And the idea that as much as I am, as I believe in goodness and awesomeness, I can't help but ask the question of, in the midst of cruel intentions, where can we go? Where can we go that doesn't end with something hurtful happening to our hearts and our souls? So that it's probably getting a little dark now, but don't worry, it'll get lighter, trust me. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And once again, he bent down and wrote on the ground. When they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the elders, and Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Let anyone without sin throw the first stone. Let anyone without sin cast the first stone. Cruel intentions, new dimensions. I want to just pause here because that's what they did. They heard that. Let anyone without sin cast the first stone. And what they had been doing and all of the things that were out of their control at that moment, their hearts and their souls kind of just tender and vulnerable and raw all at the same time. There's this moment, this word that is spoken as Jesus writes on the ground, steps up. Let anyone without sin cast the first stone. And they heard this. And the elders started walking away. The scribes probably went after them. And all the people who had been gathered in that space, they all started walking away so that all who was left was Jesus and this woman. And the space to me didn't feel like an angry space. It doesn't ring like a space of condemnation or judgment. To me, it felt like a word or a moment where we are able to pause, where suddenly the snowball is stopped, melts away. Let's make this space about what it really should be. Let's highlight what we've been doing, what's been wrong, and let's take the stones, let's drop them, and let's walk away. I love that moment of pause, a moment of reflection. The word that Jesus speaks is one that is for every single person there. It's a word that breaks the chains that allowed all of those people to get to that point. and gives them the space to let them go. Suddenly, they are reminded that they have a choice, that there is a space and a time for them, for anyone, to stop and to let it go. Let go the condemnation, let go the judgment, and that in that space, when that was spoken into it, it's like natural and supernatural happen, like right in a moment, right in a flash. Something gets released there that wasn't possible before. It's almost like you could feel the tension just. For me, when I think about the question that has stayed with me for so long as I interact with the church and as I interact with other peoples in my life, with other institutional bodies, I'm always wondering, can I trust these folks? Is it possible for us to have any kind of response in the midst of cruel intentions, in the midst of a place where we're still holding on to our chains and whatnot? Is it possible for us to have a response and an intention that breaks that, that allows us to let that go? And I feel like when I get overwhelmed by all of the darkness that's kind of coming down and sinking in, I hear that with anyone without sin, cast the first stone, and I realize no one's going to be throwing any stones at me today. It's wonderful, and it means I don't have to throw any at myself. There is a point where Christ's words of release and of mercy suddenly free us to interact in a way where cruel intentions no longer have power, and love takes precedent. Love steps in the middle. Love says that this stone is not, that's not the way of the world anymore. That's not how we interact. That's not the kingdom. Radical love means new dimensions of interaction, which do not reduce us to our sins or to the ways we are broken, but instead holds as primary our essential value and belovedness. In that moment, Jesus is enacting protection for every single person there. He is protecting the Pharisees and the scribes. What he says means that they don't have to feel, they're suddenly released from that law, that they're released from the law that they put themselves into, from the scenario of maybe having to go along with stoning a woman. They're released. They're able to step out of a bind that was going to be an awful consequence for them, depending on how Roman authority was going to take it. And so they're released in that moment. He's also releasing the woman. He is caring for her in such a way where she is able to be freed from the humiliation that happens. Instead of her being the one that's central, we're all here, we're all a part of this. And not in a way that says that one person's sin is greater than another's. It ceases to be about sin in that moment and starts to become about how we should treat and care each other, despite our sin, despite our brokenness. And that's what I think. This is the new dimension. I think it's this radical love that it's holding primary our value, that our orientation towards each other should never be one that is leading to the destruction of another. And that when we are condemning each other for things that we know we probably did 2 years ago too, we just haven't confessed it yet. When we are talking to each other in ways or interacting with each other in ways that is about holding our power or our piety or our righteousness over another, that all of that just ends in a snowball of craziness and shadiness and cruel intentions. But if we enact with each other, the way that we interact is through radical love, through Christ's love, a love that chooses to go to death on a cross for us, no matter what we're doing, in order that we may know the love of Christ, That's the kind of love that God is calling us to. And I think that's the kind of love God's calling us to in this space at Elm City Vineyard, and calling us to in our relationships, in our families, and in our larger family and community of New Haven. That it is the kind of love that chooses to value as primary the belovedness of each one of us. That is our posture and orientation towards each other. I'm going to skip. I was going to talk about the parable of the lost sheep, but I think I want to talk about how far we will go. Cruel intentions, it can feel like they'll go really, really far, right? I mean, clearly in this story, they went to ways, I mean, I couldn't even come up with that kind of thing. I mean, it'd take me a year to come up with that kind of plot. I think it's funny that I quantify how long it would take me to do something like that. But anyway, clearly still in the process of being saved. Cruel intentions will go really far. And I think when we're faced with that, it's kind of like, oh, well, what can I do with that, man? I mean, this is out of my control. This is too much for me. I don't know what I can do in this situation. But I think that this is a question of not just that Jesus chooses to love in this way, that Jesus is choosing to think of the entire community, thinking about how this has an effect on our hearts and souls. I think this is a call to us as the body that represents Christ in this community to ask, how far will we go to show that kind of love to others? That, I think, is the question. How far will we go? What can our love look like that will bring new dimensions in the midst of cruel intentions? And I'm going to keep saying that because it has a good ring, and I really like it. I think that the first piece is witness. Now, I want to caveat here and say, I don't think that there are ways where we're not Jesus. Like, we are following Jesus, and it's wonderful, but we are not Jesus. So I want to caveat here and say our ability to, take in every possible thing that could happen and then compute that and then say the right thing and everything's awesome, that is not something I think we can do. So I'm going to release us all from that. I just want to give you all permission to not feel like you need to, you know, have that exact right word at that exact right time. But I do think that because of the Holy Spirit's interaction in our life and through the example that Jesus has shown here, we have important clues in how to interact in those situations that will lead to a radical new dimension of how love happens in our midst. So do you see the distinction there? Okay. So the first, I think, is witness. One of the things that Jesus does in that entire situation is stand as a witness. Now, I get this from my friend Sandra Valdez Lopez. She is the one who taught me that that's what Jesus is doing in this situation. So this is not my great idea or anything like that, just so you all know. Witness. Jesus is a person who participates in hearing and seeing and listening to the story that is unfolding. And I think sometimes we can take that really lightly, that to be a witness, oh, that doesn't really mean anything. I'm not learning much. But how are you going to tell the story? How are you going to know the story if you are not a witness? So I think part of the ways that we love with each other and have a way of radical love is by being a present witness, someone who stays. Jesus could have easily walked out of that situation. Oh, no, 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 not today, boys. I'm going. Sorry, scribes and Pharisees. It's been real, but I'm not supposed to get trapped until, you know, a few days from now. He could have left, right? But Jesus stayed and was a witness. And I think that that is a call to all of us, that in the midst of cruel intentions, when things start getting all crazy and shady and we get that fight or flight response, I'm not saying fight or flight, I am saying witness. Be a witness. Be a responsible witness, not a YouTube witness where you get a video and paste it for everybody to see, not that kind of witness, but a person who honors the story that's taking place, because that's how you become a part of the story. That's how you become a part of love entering into that space, and part of that is witness. Standing with solidarity. So what's striking to me is that the woman is not actually completely alone. I mean, it says she's left alone, but she's standing in front of Jesus. Jesus is there with her. So as everyone is kind of faced with this moment of, oh, wow, things just got turned upside down, they all leave, and they experience different things. Some of them go off and maybe start still plotting to get rid of Jesus. Some maybe have changed. Some maybe later on have decided to join the movement. But we have one who stays, and that is Jesus. And I think that's an example to us of what the kind of love that Jesus brings. It's not just witnessing, but it's a solidarity, a standing with. See, she'd been standing up there. Everybody's kind of staring at her. As everybody leaves, suddenly she can turn around and she's not alone. And there's actually a personal interaction that can take place. I don't know about you, but one of the things that's been really powerful for me in feeling heard and encouraged is when folks choose to stand with me. And that doesn't have to mean, you know, you don't have to like kind of prop me up, you know, sometimes maybe. One of the stories that comes to mind for me, and I'm always talking about Donan, and she's gonna listen to this and be like, she's talking about me. But at our fall conference, have I told this story about fall conference? No. We had a conference about race and racial reconciliation, and I was one student of color in the midst of like majority white students, and it had been a really difficult time over the past 2 years, and so we kind of hit this point of just tension as everybody kind of told their stories and got it out there, and it could have been really, really bad. And in the middle of all of us sharing kind of our experiences with how race had been a painful part of our lives and how alone we felt, Donan kind of spoke up and said, I want to hear your story. I want to know you. I don't want you to be alone there. And she said it in a way that was just with me. And it's hard to describe kind of the emotion of the moment. But her words to me, whenever I have felt alone or as if my story doesn't matter or if that oppression is going to take over to the point where there's nothing of me left, I think of her in that moment saying, I'm here with you. See me. I stand with you. That's powerful. That is love, and I think it breaks the hold that evil can have over our lives in terms of telling us that we are nothing or that we have no value or that we have no place. In terms of thinking that our sin is going to be so great that we end up being crushed, if we stand with each other, we are able to communicate a love and a connection that says, I will help and be with you in this journey. You will not walk that road alone. That's important. Embrace. So the embrace kind of comes from the parable of the lost sheep, because it's kind of hard to get all the awesome things that Jesus does in just one passage. But if you guys know about the parable of the lost sheep, I'll just easily state, one sheep was left, went off onto its own, the 99 stayed. And Jesus is like, go and get the lost sheep. Come on. And this is not normal, because normally you would stay with the 99 sheep because you would lose a lot of money if you like let your 99 sheep just go unattended for a period of time just for one. So Jesus goes all the way out to get this lost sheep. And a lot of people see this image of Jesus kind of carrying that lost sheep back into the fold. For me, I see this as a picture of how far Jesus will go and how far he calls us to go. That it is also about embracing grace and about comfort. He says to the woman, go and sin no more. And it has this resonance of story of her life, that the words in there, the Greek words that I do not know, have a resonance of your life, let it be different from now on in a way that brings comfort, that brings embrace, that I also want to say is respectful of her person, right? That it's not like, oh, you know, yeah, it's respectful of her person. And finally, I think it's about empowerment. I think the kind of love that we can bring to situations that are shady is a love that empowers. So instead of telling everyone to, I don't know how to describe this, instead of telling everyone, yeah, you know what, go and stone her, or oh, all you Pharisees and scribes, you're all shady, you should all, you know, go to hell, whatever, where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. Like, that doesn't happen in this passage. And I think that's because Jesus is interested in empowering all of them, because the choice rests with them. He doesn't co-opt the choice for them about what their next act will be and what their next behavior will be. He kind of throws it out there, this line that anyone without sin, they be the first to cast the first stone. So now, as receivers of that word, we get to hear it and choose how we are to move forward with that. We are the ones who have the agency to decide what our next act will be. Will we drop the stone? Will we throw it? What will we do? He doesn't make that choice for them, but he does clarify what the issue is in the room. Do you see? And that's about empowerment. It's not about taking choices from people, closing doors on people, saying, oh, no, that's sin too much, that's out of here, this one's in. No. It is about still providing opportunity for all of us to have our own personal moment with Christ, with God, with the Holy Spirit about what we will do in response to the things going on in our life. It should never be our role to take that from somebody, to stop them in the midst of that process. Jesus instead empowers them in their spiritual process, in their spiritual moment of reflection and how they will move forward. Wow, I have not looked at my notes at all. So I want to say that what it means for us to interact with each other, in standing with each other, in solidarity, in witness, in embrace, and in empowerment, that all of these are things that we can actually do. These are not crazy, oh, maybe 10 years from now I'll be able to do that. No. We can do that now. I think that we can. I think we can try. I think we can make steps towards loving in these kinds of ways. And I think that it has the power, just like that mustard seed is able to be completely awesome and grow huge, even the smallest little bit of love like this has the ability to break the chains of oppression and injustice if we begin to stand in these sorts of ways with each other. It doesn't end here, but I believe this is where we can begin, where we can start to enter into the brokenness that's in our community. So I want to invite us as a community and as a people to use this verse, to use this story, to reflect on what it means to live into a new dimension of love, a dimension of love that drops the stones and reaches across to embrace each other and to embrace creation. A love which is merciful above all. A love which seeks to serve. A love which is humble. We can have faith in this love and hope in this love because even a drop of it is more powerful than any kind of cruel intention that might come our way. And that's our hope. That is our faith. That the way that Christ has laid for us is one that is more powerful than any kind of intent for evil or destruction could ever even dream to be. That is what we have as Christians and as a body and a family together.